own it for now. One thing that has made it hard at times for me to make decisions is my concern that I'd have to stick by my decision forever, or else I'd be perceived as wishy-washy. This happened frequently when I first started working with my team at Time Inc. on developing new apps. The technology was changing so quickly that we often had to go back on decisions that had already been made, such as which features to include in the final product. Working with new technologies forced me to become more comfortable with things changing quickly. This experience helped me make quick decisions and own them, while remaining aware that these calls didn't have to be forever. In short, I learned to embrace change. Things in life are constantly changing, not just technology, but also internal dynamics and politics. And sometimes it makes sense to revisit previous decisions down the road. Contrary to unhelpful myths, doing so does not make you weak or wishy-washy. Rather, it makes you decisive and flexible, which is an important balance for a leader to strike. When you make a decision, own it. Never apologize for your decision, even if you have to revisit it later or the results are not what you wanted. When I've made a decision that didn't garner positive results, I've said, "We made the best decision we could based on the facts at the time, but given where we are now as a company and what our goals are, we now need to revisit this decision." How to cut your losses. After agonizing over what to do about StyleFind, I used the decision-making technique that I knew worked best for me. I looked at the numbers, which proved once and for all that it was failing, and listened to my gut, which told me to let it go. I finally ended up suggesting that we shut down StyleFind. It was a failure, but instead of dwelling on that, I looked back to see what we could have done differently. I realized that when we were launching StyleFind, we were never able to incorporate the consumer value proposition, a statement that describes why a customer should buy a product or use a service, into its marketing and tagline. And that was one of the main reasons it failed. The fact that it wasn't easy for one consumer to concisely communicate the product's benefits to another was something that had bothered me about StyleFind from the very beginning. Later, I was able to bring what I'd learned from StyleFind to my work as an investor. I became very sensitive to how easy or difficult it is for a founder to communicate the consumer value proposition. When I sense that clearly marketing a product's benefits will be a problem, I see it as a red flag, and I usually don't invest. This strategy has helped me identify the most promising companies to invest in, and I never would have known it if not for the hard lessons I learned from my experience with StyleFind. As an investor and advisor, I have seen many women struggle with this inability to cut their losses because they fear being seen as a failure. It takes guts and confidence to cut your losses, but this is often the best way of staying afloat instead of going down with the ship. I was so impressed when Blake Lively, whose company Preserve I had invested in, decided to shutter the company. Blake told Vogue, "I never thought I would have the bravery to actually do that, to take the site dark and to say, you know what, I haven't created something that is as true and impactful as I know it can and will be. And I'm not going to continue to chase my tail and continue to put a product out there that we as a team are not proud of." Reading that, do you see Blake as a failure who should never be given another chance? Or as a strong leader who is going to bounce back bigger and better than ever? She knows that I will want to hear her next business idea. And my bet is that she will be an even stronger founder the second time around. So how do you know when is the best time to cut your losses? Of course, you don't want to go to the other extreme and give up on something too soon either. When you're unsure about which way to go, think about what would need to happen to turn things around and make this venture a success. You can usually boil it down to 3 to 4 variables. Then ask yourself what the probability of success is on each of those variables. If that probability is low, it's time to cut your losses. But if not, you still have a good chance of success. For example, I boiled StyleFind's likelihood of success down to these 3 variables. 1. We would have to make it a bigger part of InStyle.com, which was unlikely since there were other features of the site that were performing better. 2. Google would have to change its algorithm. One key factor that was hurting us was that Google had changed its algorithm, and we were getting less traffic than we'd expected. This was an external influence that was completely out of our control. Three, we would need a big marketing budget from the company. I knew that it wasn't the right time to make this ask because the company was looking to cut costs, not do more investing. Looking at these three variables and how low the probability of success was for all three, it was clear that it was time to let Stylefind go. How to get unstuck when you are making a decision. Even if you follow all of the preceding advice, chances are at some point you'll face a decision that for one reason or another is really difficult for you to make. When this happens, these are my go-to techniques. One, take a step back and think about the bigger picture. It's really easy to get too deep into the weeds, especially when you are stuck. If it's a choice between two options, ask yourself which option is more closely aligned with your overall vision and values or those of the company. Two, find someone who has dealt with a similar issue in the past and talk to them about how they made the decision. It may be someone in your company or at a different company. Don't reinvent the wheel. Most likely, someone else has already put a lot of thought into this. Tap into that knowledge to inform your own decision. Three, visualize what your world would look like if you said yes. I recently was offered a CEO role, which my ego was obviously very attracted to. But then I started visualizing what my day-to-day would look like. A two-hour commute each day to a high-pressure job, which would mean less time with my kids and on other projects that are meaningful to me. More on this in Chapter 8. Four, give yourself a break and stop thinking about it for a while. Often the best solution comes when you create headspace for yourself, like when you are taking a walk or in the shower. Take the emotions out of your decisions. My friend Chrissy Carter, who left a career on Wall Street to become a yoga teacher, has taught me so much about balancing empathy and other emotions with the need to make tough decisions. On Wall Street, Chrissy found that she had to react quickly and be very precise. While her natural inclination was to take a lot of time to contemplate and consider things from all sides before making a final decision, it was a challenge for her to quickly sift through her emotions in order to arrive at a clear decision, but she became more proficient at it the more she practiced. Chrissy learned to identify the signs that she was having an emotional reaction to an email or a piece of news and would strategically wait before responding. Then, after a day or two, she'd play Monday morning quarterback by going back to the conversation or message that upset her to figure out what triggered her. The more she did this, the quicker she caught herself when she was being triggered in real time. Then she could take that emotional reaction off the table and have a professional conversation or make a quick decision. Here are the steps she uses to take her emotions out of workplace decision-making. Identify your visceral reactions to a trigger, which could include a knot in your stomach, tension in your throat, or a tightening of your jaw. Be aware of these sensations. When you feel those physical sensations, consciously choose not to take any action at that moment. Later, go back and write out what happened like it was a scene in a play. What was said right before you felt that visceral reaction? Why do you think you reacted this way? As you become more aware of what triggers you, you'll be able to recognize when you need to take a step back and try to approach the situation with some objective clarity. Failure, confidence, and risk. Obviously, making the decision to shut down Stylefind did not end up destroying my career as I'd feared. In fact, I recall one senior executive saying to me, "No one bats a thousand. Failure comes with the territory. But when it happens, it can really shake your confidence." Understandably, we often interpret a serious setback as evidence of our inability to lead, and that makes us feel insecure. It's interesting to note how women in particular react to failure. The Harvard Business Review found that women were far less likely to apply for a leadership role if they had been turned down for a similar role in the past. Over time, this is undoubtedly one of the factors keeping women out of senior management roles. How can we become more comfortable risking failure and rejection? In their book, Art and Fear, David Bales and Ted Orland tell a story about a ceramics teacher who conducted an experiment. He divided a beginner's pottery class in half and told the people on one side that they'd be graded on quantity. The more pots they produced, the better their grade would be. Then he told the other half that they'd be graded on quality. The more perfect their pot, the better their grade would be. Guess which group made better pots? The one that was focused on quantity. Why? Because they practiced. Because they failed. And they ultimately improved their technique through trial and error. The group that was hung up on perfection never took risks, so they never failed. And as a result, they never learned or improved. I recently heard that 80% of women CEOs played team sports in high school and college. This data made perfect sense to me. In playing a team sport, women learn how not to take the team's success or failure personally. You win some, you lose some, and then you get back out there on the field the next day. Doing this over and over clearly gave those women CEOs the resilience they needed to catapult themselves to the top. Even if you think it's too late for you to join a varsity soccer team, it's never too late to learn how to cultivate the confidence to take risks. I recently helped a woman I mentor named Catherine make a big decision about whether or not to take a risk in her career. Catherine worked as a pharmaceutical sales representative and was offered a job as a sales manager. It was a promotion with a significant salary increase, but it meant moving from Chicago, where she lived with her husband and son, to North Carolina. Catherine and I walked through the potential risks. Her son had special needs, so it was important to find the right school for him. She felt that disrupting him when he was doing well in school was a big risk. Catherine's husband worked for the same company she did, and they had offered him a position in North Carolina too, so his job wasn't at stake. But Catherine was still worried about how the move would affect him. In addition, her family and her husband's family lived in the Midwest. Their entire support system was there. On the positive side, Catherine had been bored with her job for the past year or so, and was really excited about advancing her career. This promotion was a great opportunity for her to move up and take on more responsibilities. She knew that these opportunities didn't come along often. Once we had a clear sense of the potential risks and rewards, I walked her through the following questions. What would I do if my husband and son weren't a factor? Of course, Catherine did need to consider how the move might affect her family, but it was also important for her to know what her decision would be otherwise. For Catherine, it was clear that she would take the new job if she weren't worried about how it would affect her family. What would I do if they were excited for me? Catherine was lucky to have a supportive partner who was truly excited for her, but this is not always the case. Imagining what the decision would be like without the pressure of pleasing others can be really helpful for someone, like me, who overdoes it on empathy. Is this decision aligned with my values? It may sound silly, but many of us walk through life unsure of what is most important to us. Is it money, fulfillment, love, or something else? Those of us who tend to be people pleasers often forget our own values on our quest to make everyone else happy. But when you have a deep understanding of your core values, it's much easier to make a decision that is aligned with what you cherish most. Catherine realized that she valued her career and believed that she would be a better mom if she were happier at work. What is the worst case scenario? Identifying the worst thing that could happen helps eliminate the fear of the unknown. In the absolute worst case scenario, Catherine would hate her new job, her son would be miserable in his new school and stop progressing, and her husband would resent her for making them move. Not a pretty picture, but it was helpful to Catherine to face it head on. How can I mitigate the risk? There's often a way to lessen the impact of your personal risk. Sometimes when nice girls are given an opportunity, they hesitate to ask for more because they're afraid of being seen as greedy. But it's smart, not greedy, to seek out what you need in order to mitigate your risk. Catherine was able to negotiate with her company to get an equivalent job in Chicago if the new position didn't work out within a year. She also was able to rent out her home in Chicago instead of selling it and rent an apartment in North Carolina. Get rejected on purpose. I once heard Sarah Blakely, the founder of Spanx, talk about how her father encouraged her to fail as a young child. At the dinner table, he would ask Sarah and her brother, "How did you fail today?" Sarah credited this freedom to fail with giving her the confidence to take risks that have really paid off for her career. This story really stuck with me, and I can see doing this with my own sons when they're a little bit older. I also saw a TED Talk by Jia Shang, who went out and intentionally got rejected every day for 100 days in an effort to overcome his fear of rejection. He literally walked up to strangers and asked them if he could borrow $100 and requested a burger refill after finishing his lunch. This may sound silly, but he grew more and more comfortable with being rejected. As a happy side benefit, he also found that many people were kinder than he'd ever imagined. So if you're scared of taking risks because you might fail or get rejected, why not try it? Ask yourself, how am I going to fail today? You never know how it will end up helping you succeed. The downside of risk, dealing with failure. The truth is that no matter how confident you are or how much you prepare, not every risk you take is going to turn out exactly how you'd like. Take it from me. The biggest career risk I've ever taken didn't work out at all the way I expected it to. I was still at Time Inc. when I realized that my side hustle, startup investing and advising, was something I really enjoyed. My two boys were really little at the time, so I was looking for more flexibility at work. I had been in corporate media for 15 years at that point, and felt like it was time to mix it up and do something a little different. Before making any moves, I spent a lot of time thinking about what I most enjoyed about what I was currently doing. The answer was that I loved meeting startup founders and working closely with them as an advisor and mentor. It was my favorite part of the job, and yet it was something I was mostly doing for free. I was still mulling whether I should make the move to become a full-time investor when I met Mike Rothenberg. Mike was running a venture capital, VC, fund that I ended up investing in. We got along really well, and he asked me to work for him. This would mean taking a huge risk, and naturally I worried about everything, from how the decision would affect other people in my life, to what would happen if I failed. To make this crucial decision, I asked myself the same questions I had walked through with Catherine. What would I do if other people weren't a factor? In my case, my husband was very supportive of the potential move, and I already knew it would be a good choice for my boys because I'd get to spend more time with them if I left my job at Time. I was concerned, though, that my loyal team at Time might feel that I was abandoning them if I moved on. But when I asked myself what I would do if they weren't a factor, the honest answer was that I would take the risk and leave. What if they were excited for me? Imagining my team at Time being excited for me to embark on this new journey gave me a shot of real confidence to make that decision. It also helped me to see this decision in a new light, as me walking toward a new opportunity instead of walking away from something. Is this decision aligned with my values? At that stage of my career, my boys were my top priority. I also cared about staying relevant in my career. Working in VC would give me more time with my kids, and I knew it would be good for my relevancy because I'd be learning about emerging technologies and expanding my network. What is the worst case scenario? The worst case scenario was that the position wouldn't work out and I would be on my own without a platform. I also knew that my move from Time Inc. into the VC world would probably be covered in the media, so it would be embarrassing if it didn't work out. How can I mitigate the risk? For me, this was perhaps the most important question, because it made me see that I could continue doing my own personal startup investing, even while working for Mike. That way, if the move didn't go well, I'd still have my own portfolio. After answering all of these questions and doing my due diligence about Mike and his firm, I found it was much easier to make the decision. I went to work for Mike, and at first, I loved it. I was getting plugged into an incredible network in Silicon Valley, and I really enjoyed being around the enthusiasm of a youthful, energetic team. I imagined that I would work at Rothenberg Ventures, Mike's VC fund, for a few years, and then move on to a larger VC firm. But that's not the way it happened. After 2 years, I was left feeling disillusioned with VC. I found that my values were increasingly at odds with my day-to-day duties, and I realized that I would be happier investing my own money in startups instead of investing other people's money. This was when I was so glad I had thought about how to mitigate risk and had continued investing on my own. By then, I had built up a personal portfolio of 17 companies, and I was able to leave Rothenberg without having to worry about what was next. In the end, the experience didn't go exactly how I planned or how I would have hoped. But if I could go back and make a different decision, I wouldn't choose to. It was still the right decision at the time, and I gained so many positives from the experience. I have relationships with people I never would have met otherwise. I have opportunities to speak to large groups of key people that I didn't have before, and it allowed me to develop my own personal brand. It also gave me the time and flexibility to write this book and to work on personal passion projects like Girl Starter, a new reality show about female entrepreneurs. Just because I wouldn't change my decision doesn't mean that I didn't make mistakes along the way. For one, I should really have taken my own advice and cut my losses even sooner once I realized the position was not a good fit. But I didn't want to feel like I'd failed at this big new venture. It wasn't until after I summoned my confidence, cut my losses, and left that I was able to see that it wasn't a failure because I had gained so much from the experience. Bottom line, if you take a risk and it doesn't go as planned, welcome to the club. Here's how you can best get up, dust yourself off, and move forward. Ask yourself, what did I gain from this experience? If I could go back in time, what would I do differently? What will I do differently next time? Key takeaways. True confidence comes from solid evidence of your previous successes, not ego. To develop evidence-based confidence, ask yourself what process you've used in the past to make wise choices. Women have a unique stress response to tend and befriend. To make the most of this instinct, form a go-to team to run tough decisions by. These should only be people you trust, who always encourage you to be your best and to stand up for yourself. It's also helpful to discuss decisions with people who have specific expertise and who've had experiences that you're lacking. Women are more likely to become strong leaders if they learn how to take risks and fail on the playing field. To get comfortable with risk, try taking a small risk every day or make a request that you know is likely to be met with a no. The more you do this, the more comfortable with and less intimidated by failure you'll become. When you find yourself becoming emotional at work, take a step back and think about what preceded this feeling that might have triggered you. When you become aware of those triggers, you can learn when you need to take a moment before being able to make clear decisions that are free of emotion. To avoid over-empathizing to the detriment of your own success when making a decision, ask yourself what you would do if all the people in your life supported your decision. Chapter 6. Negotiate with strategy and empathy. Bridging the wage gap. As we all know, the gender wage gap is real, and it's probably not going away anytime soon. In 2015, the latest year we have data for, there was an overall 20% gap between men's and women's salaries. In other words, on average, women earned 80 cents for every man's dollar. While women have definitely made some progress over the past few decades, the rate of change has now stalled. At the rate of change between 1960 and 2001, women would reach pay equity in 2059. But at the stalled rate since 2001, we won't reach equity until 2152. The gap is even wider for women of color. In 2015, African American women earned 63 cents for every man's dollar, while Hispanic or Latina women earned only 54. If you don't think this is affecting you yet, unfortunately, all you have to do is wait. On average, women earn 90% of men's salaries until the age of 35. And then the wage gap begins to widen as we get older, regardless of race or education levels. Pretty alarming, isn't it? But what's causing this? A study from 2012 proved that stereotypes and biases are one major cause of the wage gap. In that experiment, science professors who were hiring a lab manager were presented with two resumes that were identical, except for one key difference. One had the name John, while the other had the name Jennifer. John was judged to be more competent and hireable than Jennifer. And here's the kicker. The professors ultimately offered him a starting salary that was about 12% higher than Jennifer's. If that's not infuriating enough, think about this. You don't even have to be human to be financially penalized for being female. In a 2014 study, participants were asked to estimate how much they would pay for two identically performing robots, one named Julie and one named James. The robot named James was deemed to be worth a whopping 25% more than Julie. Crazy, right? I've seen in my own career how stereotypes can cause men to be valued more than women. Earlier on in my career, I was working on the board of a nonprofit doing a compensation review. Every year, the board went through each member of the management team and decided what his or her compensation would be for the following year. We were talking about potential salary increases for a man and a woman who were peers, and an older woman on the board recommended a higher salary increase for the man, explaining that he was the primary breadwinner in his family, while the woman was single and didn't have the same financial stress. Thankfully, a man on the board spoke up and said, "That's not something we should assume or factor into our decision-making. It looks to me like they're pretty equal in terms of performance and the value they bring to the organization." The rest of the board agreed and decided to give them the same salary increase. This was the first time I had actually heard someone so explicitly use traditional gender roles as a reason a man should receive a higher salary than a woman who was his equal, and I was shocked. It was particularly disheartening to hear a woman perpetuating this stereotype and actually advocating for the man to receive a higher salary purely because of his gender. I knew that these biases existed, of course, but this experience proved to me how deeply ingrained they were and that they were actively holding women back. At the same time, the outcome gave me hope. I was impressed that the man on the board had stepped up to do the right thing. This showed me that there are men out there who are committed to fighting for equality and the importance of speaking up when facing these types of situations. The negotiating gap. Besides speaking up for other women when we're at the table and have an opportunity to do so, what can we do to keep shrinking the wage gap? Some of the world's most successful and inspiring women argue that we must do a better job of negotiating our salaries in order to close this gap. To some extent, I agree with this stance. There are proven differences in the way men and women negotiate, or rather in whether we do it at all. A recent study of MBA graduates found that half of the male graduates negotiated their first job offers, while only an eighth of the women chose to negotiate. This means that almost 90% of the women very likely left money on the table. As a result, according to the study, the men had starting salaries that were an average of 7.6% higher than the women's. I have been just as guilty of this as those female MBA graduates. Over the first 9 years of my career, I either received a promotion or changed jobs 5 separate times, and every time I took the first salary that was offered to me. I was always so grateful to have the job that it never even occurred to me to negotiate. Now I know that the first offer a company makes is often not their best possible offer. There are normally salary ranges that employers are willing to give for each position. Their first offer may be at the bottom of that range, leaving room to negotiate higher. So if you take the initial offer, there's a good chance that you're missing out. Speaking to recruiters is one good way to stay on top of the market, to see where there is heat, which areas are expanding and which are contracting. This, by the way, is also a way to add value to your company in your current role. Understanding market forces leads to better decisions at all levels of an organization. I offer more tips on connecting to recruiters in Chapter 7. The first time I negotiated my salary was 8 years into my career when I left Coke for MoviePhone, and even then it was by accident. When I told Coke that I was leaving, they countered in an effort to get me to stay. The counteroffer from Coke was so tempting that I went back to MoviePhone and told them that I was now considering staying. To my surprise, MoviePhone stepped up and offered more than Coke's counteroffer. Realizing that I had successfully, if unintentionally, negotiated a better deal in terms of salary, bonuses, and stock options, I ended up making the move. After this enlightening experience, it struck me that I hadn't actually needed Coke to counter in the first place. I could have negotiated with Moviefone right from the beginning based on my own merits. And I realized that I could have been doing that all along in my previous jobs. This was a pivotal moment for me. I had finally learned my value. Going forward, I always made sure to review my compensation package thoroughly, instead of accepting it by default, and negotiated with confidence when I felt it was appropriate. As I moved forward in my career, I saw that many of the young women who worked for me were making the same mistakes I had. They didn't negotiate as a matter of course. This became so predictable that I began to expect and even plan for it when I prepared my annual performance reviews with my team. When preparing salary increases ahead of these reviews, I was careful to focus on performance. But even then, I was aware that the men on my team were more likely to negotiate. And sometimes they did end up getting more than their female counterparts, who usually did not negotiate. So why are women so much less likely to negotiate? In my experience, it goes back to the people-pleasing mentality that is so easy for women to feel pressured into. Many women worry that they'll come across as aggressive, pushy, or even greedy if they negotiate for themselves. This concern is certainly something I can relate to personally, and I hate to say it, but it turns out that there's research to prove that this worry is valid. In a 2011 study at Emory University, managers were told they would have to discuss raises with their employees. In this case, they offered the men on their teams raises that were 2.5 times higher than those they offered to women with equal skills and experience. This was before any negotiations had even begun. But when the same managers were told they would not have to justify or discuss the amount of the raise, they offered male and female employees equal raises across the board. In other words, these managers didn't feel comfortable lowballing male employees when they would be forced to talk about it. They assumed that in their discussions, the men would fight harder for higher salaries than the women. So they gave them more from the get-go, 2.5 times more. And this was despite the fact that they knew the men were not truly worth more, as proved by the equal increases they gave when there was no discussion required. Once negotiations start, things often get even worse for women. In a series of studies out of Harvard and Carnegie Mellon, evaluators were asked to rank potential employees based on whom they would most like to work with. Both male and female evaluators consistently ranked a woman lower if she had previously initiated negotiations for a higher salary. The same judgment was not inflicted on the men who had negotiated. In a follow-up, the evaluators themselves were asked if they would have negotiated if they had been the employees in the same scenario, and most of the women said no. But they weren't just being meek or people-pleasers. They knew full well that they'd be penalized for negotiating. I believe this is why so many women fail to negotiate for themselves. We're aware of the unfair judgment we face and decide it's ultimately not worth it. How to negotiate successfully without being penalized for being pushy is one of the questions I'm asked the most by women I mentor. And this topic clearly resonated with the women I surveyed. Here's what they had to say. I am a freelancer, so I constantly have to negotiate, and I hate it. It doesn't come naturally to me, and I always feel like I'm being unfairly judged just for asking for what I'm worth. When I took my new job, I didn't negotiate, and I found out later that a male peer negotiated for a similar position and is making over 20% more than me. It makes me feel resentful every day, but I'm not sure what I can do about it now. Although I was uncomfortable doing it, I forced myself to negotiate hard for my current job, and I got the salary and package I wanted. But my male boss still makes cutting remarks 3 years later about how I'm draining his pockets. Nice and strategic job negotiation tactics. So what should we do about all of this? Most of the advice offered to women on this topic is to try to be tough and negotiate like a man. But my advice is a little different. I think it's important for us to be aware of the biases we are facing. And instead of plowing ahead and negotiating aggressively, or failing to negotiate altogether, it's essential to use our relational skills to negotiate strategically, in a way that is good for the people on both sides of the table. Here's how. Focus on communal benefits. Studies have shown that women who negotiate communally, meaning with an eye toward what is best for the organization, instead of just what is best for themselves, have a better chance of success. This means that in addition to discussing why you deserve the promotion and salary increase, you should talk about how your talents and experiences will add value to the company. For example, the talents and network that I bring to the table are critical for the company to meet its biggest goals. Is this a way of playing to a stereotype because women are typically expected to think of others instead of themselves? I don't think so. You're still speaking up for your achievements and asking for what you're worth, but just doing it in a way that gives you the best chance of success. There's nothing submissive about that. Know your value. If you feel uncomfortable negotiating on your own behalf, knowing exactly what you're worth according to the market can help you feel more confident. This can be difficult in companies that are not transparent about salaries and other benefits, but there are other ways to find out what you're worth. From early on in my career, it's been my impression that men talk to each other about money much more than women. But the more we're willing to have open conversations about our worth, the more we can work to close the wage gap. It took me a long time to get to know my own value as an advisor. For a while, I asked for nothing in return for my time and advice. I'd go to meeting after meeting, sharing my advice for free. Finally, a good friend who also does some advising said to me, "Fran, why are you doing all this work for free? I usually do one introductory meeting at no charge. After that, if people want my advice, they have to pay me as a consultant or give me equity as an advisor." This made me rethink how I responded to the endless requests for my advice. I decided that I'd do a 30-minute call or introductory meeting with a founder before requiring compensation as an official advisor. But I never would have known to ask for what I'm worth if my friend hadn't been transparent with me about how she handled her own consulting fee. Now I make sure to stay on top of my current value and how it may change over time. When I'm having casual networking meetings with other advisors, I ask them, "What kind of equity have you been getting in the companies you advise?" If you're not sure what you're worth, make an effort to find out. Services like Glassdoor have a lot of valuable salary information that you can look at to get a sense of what your peers are making. The recruiters you connect with can also tell you what type of compensation they're seeing, based on your experience and career level. Know all the levers. I find that in negotiations, we often narrowly define compensation. When exploring a new job and thinking about the negotiation process, try to think more broadly. There's more to a compensation package than just a salary and benefits. Though, of course, those are important. There are also often overlooked perks you can push for if the company is not willing to go higher on your salary. Here are just a few. Flexible schedule. Part-time or working remotely. Educational support. Tuition reimbursement for continuing education or graduate courses. Bonuses. Stock options. Extra vacation time. Gym membership. Fridays off during the summer. Remember, too, that your priorities will shift over time. When I was in my 20s, salary was hugely important to me, so my husband and I could start saving. By the time I was in my 40s, flexibility became more important because of my children. Your priorities may be different than mine. A friend of mine had a side hustle she was passionate about, and it was important to her that she was able to continue working on it. She was willing to forego a little on her full-time salary to have permission and flexibility to continue working on her side project. These are all pieces of the puzzle, and the importance of each will likely change over the course of your career. Decide which is most valuable for you before you begin a negotiation. Time it right. Your empathy is a great asset when determining the right moment to ask for what you deserve. When will your boss feel the most open and accepting of the discussion? I once had a boss who was like two different people in the morning and in the afternoon. Whenever I wanted something, I made sure to get time on his calendar early in the day to have the best chance of success. To me, this is the epitome of being empathetic and strategic. No matter who your boss is, it's always a good time to ask if you've recently had a big, high-profile win at work. People in the company will know about your accomplishment, and your boss is not going to want to lose you. This is a time when you shouldn't wait for an annual review to ask for the raise or promotion you deserve. Instead, seize the moment when you have a lot of momentum and power. Get the data. Negotiations should always be more objective than subjective. By that, I mean never let negotiations be about personal issues or what you feel you deserve. Along those lines, try to avoid talking about personal circumstances like expenses that you have to pay. Promotions and raises should be about performance and hard data, not feelings and extenuating circumstances. Those concerns are pretty much irrelevant to the company and can be easily swatted away. Especially when you're feeling insecure in a negotiation, it's always a good idea to fall back on solid evidence you've collected to help you make your case. This can be data about your accomplishments or about the company's current financial picture. For example, prepare concrete evidence of the value you've created for your organization. Whether you are a teacher who's launched a successful project at your school, or an accountant who has implemented a program that saved the company a lot of money. Sometimes the value you've added is not tied to a specific product or project. It may be that you've created a culture for your team that has resulted in improved morale and retention, or you took the initiative and launched a new business resource group at the company. Financial data is just as important for you to have in mind when facing a negotiation. You have to have numbers at your fingertips to justify your requirements, including everything you may be leaving behind. For example, I recently mentored two different women who were both moving on from their jobs before the end of the year and would therefore be leaving their year-end bonuses on the table. Neither of them had thought to ask for a signing bonus with their new companies to compensate for that lost money. I explained that from their new employers' perspectives, it would be difficult to argue with the hard data about the money they were leaving behind. And sure enough, both women were able to negotiate successfully for significant signing bonuses. It's also hard to argue with market price. When I was at Time Inc., a young woman on my team came to me and said, "Look, I know that people who are doing the same job as me at other media companies are making this much money. This is the range." She was right. And by presenting it to me in that way, she gave me no other option than to find a way to get her the raise she deserved, or risk losing her. I've also relied on market data when negotiating in my own career. When I first took the job at Time Inc., the title they offered me was General Manager of People Digital. But I knew that the person who had the same position at Sports Illustrated had a president title. I went back to my future boss and asked for a title that matched. But he said, "Sports Illustrated's digital brand is already a proven success. We're just getting people off the ground. How about we keep your title as GM and revisit it in a year when we see how we're doing?" I thought this was fair. After a year, we had proven success with the digital brand, and my boss was then comfortable giving me the president title. When you're negotiating a salary, a promotion, or even a title, you might not get what you want right away, but if you get the data and ask, it's much more likely for you to end up on a path toward getting it. Represent. Here's an intriguing fact. Research tells us that women actually outperform men when negotiating on behalf of someone else. Do women feel more comfortable when the negotiation is not about them because they don't risk coming across as greedy or because the person they're negotiating with doesn't penalize them because of these double standards? I would venture to say it's probably a little bit of both. This goes back to communal negotiations. Negotiating on behalf of someone else makes us seem like we care more about others than ourselves, a trait that's traditionally valued in women and reinforced by society. To me, this is actually empowering. It shows that we do have the raw talent to do a good job of negotiating. But something happens when we're negotiating on behalf of ourselves. Our confidence goes out the door. If this happens to you, the next time you're preparing to negotiate that salary increase or promotion, think about how you would approach the conversation if you were representing your best friend or your sister instead of yourself. then take that confidence and conviction and apply it to you. What I wish I knew when I asked for a raise in my 20s. When I was in my 20s, the thought of asking for a raise terrified me. What if I get turned down? Will my boss think I'm greedy or pushy? Do I even really deserve more money? This kind of hesitation holds many women back from asking for more at work. I get it, because I've been there, and I've mentored dozens of women who have been there too. But while asking for a raise isn't always easy, I've learned that it certainly doesn't have to be terrifying either. Below are five tips and reminders I wish I could tell my 20-something self back when I was wondering whether and how to ask for more. 1. Remember, the world is not going to end if you get no for an answer. What's the worst thing that can happen after you ask for a raise? You're not going to get fired. You're not going to get a demotion. No, obviously isn't the answer you want. But unless you're completely off base in your request, it won't damage your career or cause anyone to see you in a negative light. If anything, it sends a message that you're confident, savvy, and serious about professional growth. 2. You have succeeded before. Keep a record of your accomplishments on an ongoing basis. Write them down, referencing specific numbers and examples whenever possible. When it's time to ask for a raise, these examples will remind you of why you deserve one. Better yet, they'll serve as proof points during your conversation. The most compelling requests for raises I've received focus on the person's impact and the concrete results she's achieved. 3. Be confident and keep it positive. The delivery of your message matters. If you sound like you're not sure about whether you deserve a raise, it may raise doubts for the person across the table. It will also tip them off that it's easy for them to say no. As such, be sure to maintain strong eye contact, sit up straight, and try to keep filler words like and just to a bare minimum. Enter the meeting with high energy, being sure to emphasize what you love about your job and the company. 4. Stop waiting for the perfect moment. You can be strategic by using the timing tips earlier in this chapter. If you keep waiting for the perfect moment, however, you're going to be waiting a long time. There will always be a new potential accomplishment on the horizon. Don't procrastinate. Push yourself to ask now. 5. Use no to fuel your next steps. If your boss tells you it's not going to happen, ask why not. Get as much specific feedback as possible so you can figure out what steps you need to take to get to the next level. Leave the meeting knowing precisely what you have to accomplish and by when. And then check in regularly with your boss or manager to ensure you're on track. On-the-job negotiations. We tend to think of negotiations in terms of salaries, promotions, and titles. But no matter what industry you're in, it's likely that you'll find yourself in some sort of negotiations while on the job, too. During the course of simply doing your job, you may end up negotiating for more resources, such as hiring more people on the team, contract terms with a vendor, a launch date for a specific initiative, which normally involves asking for more time, rates with a freelance worker, the overall budget for a certain project, and so on. The point is, learning how to become an effective negotiator is inevitably going to help you be better at your job. Avoid paying the a-hole tax. As intimidating as negotiating may seem, the truth is that being good at it relies on the very skills that nice girls tend to have in spades. Essentially, when you are authentically nice and use your empathy to build strong relationships, people are more likely to agree to favorable terms during a negotiation and say yes to your requests. Anne Frost, who teaches deal-making to executives, claims that when people are rude during negotiations, it ends up costing them. She calls this an a-hole tax. Nobody likes to negotiate with an ass, she says, so they make them pay an a-hole tax, often without even realizing it. I've seen this happen in my own career. When I was at MoviePhone, AOL acquired our company. I was running finance for MoviePhone, so I was in charge of leading the due diligence on our side of the acquisition. Due diligence is a sticky process that can become confrontational because it involves setting a price for the company, and there's a lot at stake. I knew this going in and wanted to do whatever I could to avoid unproductive conflict. I also knew that I'd be spending a lot of time with the people at AOL who were evaluating our business, so I made a big effort to get to know them on a personal level. At the same time, we had to convince the AOL folks that MoviePhone was worth $525 million. It was a big responsibility to take them through the financials and explain our revenue models and assets. But I made sure to keep this process collaborative and inclusive and make it clear that we shared the same goal, which was for the deal to go through. We set up a conference room for the AOL team in our offices. Instead of sitting in my office all day, I spent a good part of my day sitting in the conference room, doing my work while making myself available to the team if they had questions. By sharing space with them, I naturally got to know them on a personal level and developed relationships with the team. This collaborative attitude paid off in so many ways after the acquisition was final. Now we all had to work together, and I was starting off at an advantage because I had already developed positive relationships with the team. This made the transition much easier and smoother than it otherwise may have been. I learned a lot from this experience and absolutely made sure to put relationships first at every stage of my career. Later, when I was at Time Inc., Mitch Klaff was our chief information officer. As the head of technology, he was under a lot of pressure to keep the infrastructure running. I sensed that in many ways, his was a thankless job. A lot of the people coming to him were unhappy. Their email wasn't working, or they didn't have the funding they needed for a project. I took the time to get to know Mitch as a person, ask about his family, and listen when he was frustrated about something. So I got along with Mitch really well, while many of my colleagues had a hard time getting him to prioritize their initiatives. At one point, my team needed to accelerate a product launch, which meant we need a lot more resources from Mitch's team. I assumed my boss would ask him directly, but instead she said, "Fran, you need to ask Mitch. He can't say no to you." Sure enough, when I walked into Mitch's office, he laughed and said, "Oh no, here she comes again. What are you going to get out of me this time, Fran?" When I got a yes from him, of course, my team was incredulous. But it wasn't magic. Mitch was inclined to say yes to me because we already had a relationship. In other words, I didn't just go to him when I had a problem or needed something. I connected with him on a personal level. This wasn't a power move. As a so-called nice girl, being empathetic came naturally to me, and it simply worked to my advantage when it was time to negotiate or ask for something. When they go low, nice girls go high. Perhaps you're thinking, this is all fine and good, but what if the person you're negotiating with isn't as nice as you are? Unfortunately, this happens far too often. A nice girl tries to use all of the kind and collaborative negotiating strategies in this chapter, but the person on the other side of the table isn't playing nice at all. Luckily, there are ways to successfully negotiate without ever stooping to a bully's level. My friend Mimi Feliciano, a real estate expert and philanthropist, told me that she was trained in a technique called Best Alternative to a Negotiated Agreement, also known as BATNA, which helps you figure out what to do if a negotiation isn't working out. It often requires creative thinking to make a negotiation move forward collaboratively, even when it starts to get ugly. Mimi found that when she used this technique, she was able to find out-of-the-box win-win solutions. For example, she was negotiating a big development deal that involved buying several different properties, and she needed one last piece to make it all work. But the owner was being a bully, mean, impossible, and unfair. Everything had to be his way. She had offered to split the difference between where she was and where he was, but he refused to budge. Instead of becoming mad or defensive or stooping to the owner's level by pushing back on him to change his bottom line, Mimi became creative and thought about whether or not there was any other way to get the owner what he needed and still be whole, i.e. not lose money. So she looked to find an interested third party who might be able to help. She knew that the town where the development was located really wanted the project to go through. So she went to them and explained her dilemma, and they offered to mediate the agreement. With the town's assistance, the negotiation worked out so that everyone got something and the project moved forward. A hardline negotiator may have seen this as a failure because Mimi didn't get the owner to budge on his number. But looking at it through a more collaborative lens, it was a win for Mimi, the owner, and the town, because they all ended up with what they wanted, and the project moved forward. Mimi's goal was not to beat the other person, but rather to collaborate with them so they could both win, and that's exactly what she did. Empathy and negotiation, a win-win. To me, a successful negotiation results in a win for both sides, not a situation where I've bulldozed the other side into giving me what I want at their expense. For both sides to win, they each need to truly understand what is important to the other. This requires real empathy. I first learned this art of empathetic negotiation from my father. As a skilled worker, my father often had to negotiate his fee for a project. When we first moved to New York from Italy, his English wasn't very good, so he relied on nonverbal communication to express his confidence and authentic kindness. He held the other person's gaze, affectionately tapped them on the shoulder, and always smiled. He was charming, but his kindness was always grounded in an understanding of where the other person was coming from and what was important to them. My dad's entire business depended on word-of-mouth referrals, so he wanted everyone who left a negotiation with him to feel good about it. While my dad did this intuitively, he was never formally trained to negotiate. Experts agree that using empathy is the best way to get to a win-win outcome. Negotiation expert William Ury says that a successful negotiation is one that improves the relationship between the participants. To do this, instead of trying to maintain a winning position, you must focus on the interests of both parties, the things you are each trying to change, create, and/or protect. Once you're clear on your respective goals, you can find a way to both get what you want. A woman I mentor named Anna recently took on a new role in marketing for a big newspaper publisher. Her first assignment was to find new software to manage their customer database. Anna found a startup with a really impressive product that she thought would work well for her company. When it came time to negotiate the monthly licensing fee, she wasn't sure what amount would be fair. She came to me asking for advice about how to negotiate the fee. My response surprised Anna. I asked, "Why would you pay anything at all?" I told Anna that she was bringing so much value to this startup just by working with them, because her employer was a major publisher. That is, it would be a huge coup for the startup to have a renowned company like that as their first partner. Based on my feedback, Anna decided to negotiate a free 3-month pilot program with the startup. I encouraged her to start by voicing what Anna thought the other party wanted, as well as her own goals. She could say, for example, "I imagine that your goal is to get your software into as many customers' hands as possible. Signing on with a major publisher will give you a lot of credibility that will be more valuable to you than a monthly licensing fee. My goal is for my company to find the most effective software to communicate with our customers with the least amount of financial risk possible. I'm sure that if we put our heads together, we can come up with a way to ensure both of our needs are met." If the other party agreed about those goals, I told Anna to move into the actual proposal. "So here's how I'm thinking about this. We can do a 3-month pilot, during which I'm willing to invest resources in testing the software. You'll get to tell people that we're your first customer, and you'll get all of our feedback when the 3 months are up, which will make the product even stronger. This way, we'll get to try out the product without taking a risk, and if it works out after the 3 months, we can start paying a licensing fee." Finally, I told Anna that if she got stuck, to keep coming back to, how can we make this work? By saying "we," she would nicely and empathetically remind the other person that they were on the same team. Instead of competing, they were in this together. As it developed, this type of negotiation came naturally to Anna, and she came to terms with the startup founder that ended up being a win for both of them. Key takeaways. Women don't tend to negotiate for themselves as much as their male peers. This is a major factor in the gender wage gap. Instead of accepting a first offer, never be afraid to ask for what you deserve. In negotiations, focus on the objective and true value you add to the organization, instead of all the reasons you feel you want a higher salary. Gather as much data as possible ahead of time to use as backup. Empathy is an asset when negotiating on the job. Always try to link what you want with what the other party wants. And if you get stuck, go back to, how can we make this work? It often takes creative problem solving to find a solution when facing